We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When Alex, a gray parrot, died in September of 2007, his passing was taken note of by the news media. NPR's Melissa Block said, "Alex shattered the notion that parrots are only capable of mimicking words." The woman who worked with and loved Alex, Irene Pepperberg, said he was special because a bird with a brain the size of a shelled walnut could do the kinds of things that young children do. And that changed our perception of what we mean by bird brain. It changed the way we think about animal thinking. Today, we'll explore the intelligence of animals and the human-animal bond with Irene Pepperberg. She's the best-selling author of Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Irene Pepperberg is in Champaign-Urbana for a public lecture this evening at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Her talk this evening is set for 7 o'clock. The lecture, Contemplating Creatures, Irene Pepperberg and the Hidden World of Animal Intelligence. The talk is free and open to the public. It will be held in the large animal clinic auditorium of the College of Veterinary Medicine in Urbana. Irene Pepperberg is an associate research professor of psychology at Brandeis University and teaches animal cognition at Harvard University. Again, if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, give us a call or drop us an email, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Irene Pepperberg, so good to have you here in the studio with me this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Over the course of my life, I've had the great pleasure to live with cats and dogs, each with a unique personality. What was Alex like?
Alex was very full of himself. He knew he was smart. He knew he could do amazing things, and he made sure that the rest of us knew that, too.
Yeah. Well, there's one story I'm thinking about now when he learned the concept no, and this was very early in the going. This was like maybe you hadn't even had him for a year.
Yes, he's, you know, so much of this stuff came around in ways that we didn't really expect. You know, I think actually not so much knowing no, but the I'm sorry incident is probably even a little bit more fun, where I had left him alone just to go to the washroom, and I had left my coffee mug in a spot that I didn't think he could reach. And I came back, and there was Bird on the floor with shattered coffee mug all around him. And like any mom, you know, there's this horror, the things running through your head that, oh, my gosh, you could have, you know, killed yourself, da, da, da. And you start, oh, you bad bird, you know, why did you do that, blah, blah. And then I stop, and I'm thinking, this is a parrot. You know? He's doing what parrots do, which is explore, and he explored. And so I... You know, and I had been carrying on quite loudly for a moment or two before this. And I stopped and I picked him up and said, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. And he looked at me and obviously got it very quickly that saying this phrase, I'm sorry, stops somebody screaming. Because anytime he would do something bad, like bite us, and we, you know, start to, ah, you know, saying this very pathetic voice, I'm sorry. And of course, there was no contrition, but he had learned the appropriate phrase to really tone us down.
Another story you tell that made me laugh, you were working with him on phonemes. What are phonemes?
Little bits of sound that make up words. And the point of this was to see if he understood that his words were made up of bits of sound that could be chopped apart and recombined in novel ways to make up new sounds. So it's like knowing, you know, C-O-R-N is corn and C-O-R-K is cork, and the N and the K would be considered a phoneme that you mix and match to make the new words. So at the time, we were at the Media Lab at MIT, which is a separate part of MIT, and it's supported by sponsors who give many thousands of dollars a year to get intellectual property rights for what was done at the lab. And twice a year, they come by to see what we were doing with all this money. And at the time, we were working on something called InterPET Explorer, which was a very simplistic, but the basic idea was a web browser for parrots so they could entertain themselves when the owners were not there. So we were all set up to demo this. But the people who came in, these are CEOs of all these companies, they wanted to see Alex doing phoneme work. Okay, you know, they're paying the bills. We'll show them. And the phoneme work meant we took a tray and we put little refrigerator letters, just like you do for children, different colors, different letters, and having him sound out the letters. And this was kind of boring for him. So the deal was if he did something properly, he could ask whatever he wanted for a reward. So he, you know, we start, Alex, you know, what sound is blue? And it's an S, and he goes, and we say, good birdie. And he goes, want a nut? I'm going, uh-uh, we can't do this. We can't have him. I only have these people here for 5 minutes. I can't have him sitting there eating nuts. So I say, Alex, just wait. You know, you'll get it in a little bit. You know, what sound is purple? Shh. Good birdie, because it was S-H, and we do this. And he goes, want a nut? And he's a little bit more emphatic. And we're doing this 4 or 5 times, and each time he's getting a little bit more emphatic, and each time saying, no, just wait. And finally, he looks me straight in the eye and goes, want a nut? N-a-t. And, you know, first of all, it was, you know, how stupid are you? Do I have to spell it for you? But he was sounding out the word nut. And the really important thing was that N and T had been trained, but the was not, and he had figured that out by himself. So he had showed us he was so far ahead of where we were in what was going on that, you know, it was like, why are we doing this same stupid stuff? Can we just go ahead?
Hello.
Yes.
I'm trying to tell you something.
That's right.
So your potential sponsors must have been pretty impressed at the end of the day.
Well, I don't think they even realized how impressive this was. And we're trying to make it look like, oh, sure, you know, he always does things like this. And, you know, we're trying to pick our jaws up from the from the floor.
Speaking of high-tech interfaces for parrots to keep them entertained, that's really important. They really need stimulation, don't they?
Yes, these are flock animals. In the wild, they live in large flocks. They're never alone. A single bird in the wild is a dead bird because it can't forage and look out for predators at the same time. So you never see a single bird. You always see at least a pair. Usually you see them in groups of 4 or 5 for foraging. At night, there are these huge roosts of, you know, maybe even a couple hundred birds. So it's just companionship is not a treat. This is just normal for them. And so when people, you know, buy them and leave them home for 8 hours a day with nothing to do except maybe chew on a piece of wood, these birds get very frustrated. Many times they start doing things like feather plucking. If they don't take it out on themselves, they'll take it out on the owner. So the owner comes home after 8 hours thinking, oh, the bird's going to be so excited to see me. And the bird's got the attitude of a 4-year-old who's been in a playpen for 8 hours with a snack and a toy and is not a very happy camper.
Yeah.
So these are really big issues. And when people say to me, oh, I want to buy a parrot because I've read your book and blah, 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 I say, so what's your lifestyle like? And they say, oh, well, I work, you know, 8 hours a day and I have a 2-hour commute. And I say, get a goldfish. You know, I'm not saying that parrots are bad pets. I know people who, you know, basically can come home for lunch, or people who work at home, or people who could take their bird with them. Some people have the kind of job they can take the bird to work with them, and it's great. But you really have to understand their psychology before you get one of them.
And another thing that I think we should point out, and that's something that you mentioned as you came into the studio this afternoon, they live very long lives.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, one of the it has a very happy ending, but one of the saddest stories was I'm in New York for something, and a friend of mine says, we're going to visit the Brooklyn Borough president. And I said, okay, but why? And she says, because his in-laws bought a baby gray when they were 78 years old. And now the president and his wife have inherited a 2.5-year-old parrot, and they know nothing about parrots, and they want to do everything best for this bird, and it has worked out wonderfully. Everybody's bonded, and it's a great story, but some of these stories don't work out like that. These birds live, some of them can live 100 years. I mean, average parrot life, about 40 or 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think about that, you know? I mean, you don't... Unless you know that you have children or you know, nieces or nephews or somebody who really is going to love that bird, you want to make sure that you don't, you know, you can buy a rehome a bird. So if you're, you know, middle-aged and you really want a parrot, there are a lot of these older birds who have been left because of situations mm-hmm. like that that could be adopted, but you really need to think these things through.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Irene Pepperberg. She's the best-selling author of Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. She's in Champaign-Urbana for a public lecture this evening at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. It is open and free to the public. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, or toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also join us by email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener who's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak to the capabilities of parrots in the wild to actually string together syntax and communicate with each other in the way that you did with Alex. I know that there are three types of birds, right? Three taxa with highly specialized brains for vocal communication, and that's, of course, the songbirds, the parrots, and the hummingbirds. But do you think they actually communicate using syntax or specific meanings in the wild?
We suspect that they do, but we don't know for sure. My students were trying to study this in the wild. Unfortunately, they were chased by machete-wielding poachers, and that sort of put an end to the project. But before that happened, they did tape a lot of the vocalizations. The problem was we couldn't tape the birds individually. So we got huge numbers of vocalizations that we could categorize as sort of affiliative or aggressive or neutral. And what we needed to have done, which we couldn't do, was to do playbacks. So play these in situations and see how the birds would respond. But to get to the real heart of your question, I don't think I could have trained Alex to do what he did in the lab if it wasn't based on some kind of existent abilities in the wild. So whether they use a complex syntax, probably not. I mean, Alex's syntax wasn't all that complex either, but they probably have certain things, certain vocalizations that we clearly knew. Certain vocalizations were used in affiliative context. Was there a range? So one meant, you know, I like you, versus the other means I love you, be my mate. Probably. There were probably different variations that we were not able to tease apart, but I believe that something like that was there, or maybe different calls for different types of predators. We only had one predator in our area, which were hawks. So our birds didn't need to have multiple types of predator alarms, but I'm guessing that birds in areas with hawks versus snakes would have different alarm calls and things like that.
Yeah, I'm familiar, much more familiar with songbird song and calls or what yeah. You know, the line is blurred. But I know that in some species they can be extremely simple, and in others they can be extremely complex. But it's hard to assign meaning or figure out what they're talking about.
Well, through playbacks, I mean, if you look at things like the song sparrows, they will sing differently in different ways. So if a bird that they know is just sort of next to them, they will sing another song in that bird's repertoire to just let it, hey, I know you're Sam and I know you're there. If that bird impinges on the territory, they will directly match the song that that bird is singing. So it sort of ups the ante and lets it know, not only do I know it's you and it's Sam, but you are, you know, in my territory and I know that, so I'm going to match you exactly. So we can figure out more of these things when we can do these kinds of playbacks.
Yeah, nothing like I Want a Nut, though. But thank you very much. I really admire your work.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Irene Pepperberg. She's an associate research professor of psychology at Brandeis and teaches animal cognition at Harvard University. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, I'll invite you, our listeners, to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Something my husband and I have noticed is, you know, crows are found so commonly across North America, but our crows here in Illinois have a different kind of sound. Although they caw, there's a different kind of sound that they make in eastern Canada. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Well, crows are technically songbirds, which, you know, you don't sort of think about those caws as song, but they are technically songbirds. And songbirds often have different dialects. And so you find, I mean, when I moved to the Midwest from the East, I was amazed at listening because the cardinals, I was used to a certain cardinal song, and then I would see this cardinal, and it was singing something just a little bit different. And so it was a different dialect. You know, the Indiana dialect was different from the Massachusetts dialect. And we find this is true in places like California with the white-crowned sparrows. The dialects are so intense that you can be from different parts of San Francisco. You've got different dialects. So there's the Golden Gate dialect and the Presidio dialect.
Very interesting. Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Pepperberg, my name is Sonia, and my husband and I are so admirable with your work, and we have five parrots of our own.
Wow.
My question is, what made you decide with African greys? And then just a second question, are you still planning on working with Griffin and Wart like you had been with Alex?
I chose greys because people had already done a lot of work on their intelligence. In the 40s and 50s, Kuhler had looked at number concepts in these birds and showed that they really were doing some fascinating abilities that I'm going to talk about tonight in my lecture, but they had certain number concepts. People in Russia were showing that they actually had kind of an object permanence concept, that they recognized an object detour, so they knew if you hid something behind a wall to walk around the wall to get to it and things like that. And they were also extremely clear talkers. Again, this had been documented before I started my work, so that's why I chose the gray. And in terms of working with Griffin and Wart, Wart's also, his real name is Arthur, which we're trying to use more to get him sort of grown up. Yes, we are. We're looking at optical illusions with them to see if they literally see the world the way we do. And we're also working on a project that was inspired by my colleagues in France who came over to work with me for this last past summer on whether the birds would cooperate with one another in a task which would allow them to get more nuts if they would cooperate. They'd always get something if they just were selfish, but we're trying to see how that would work out. So we're doing that project, too.
Well, as I said, we're enormous fans. Thank you. We look forward to seeing you tonight. It's a great honor to have you here in Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You note for readers of Alex and Me that when you began your work with Alex in the late 1970s, animals were seen as having little or no capacity for cognition or thought. How challenging was that for you as you began to forge ahead with your work?
It was a really big issue. And again, it was also just after I started the work with Alex, a lot of the work that was being done on animal language was being challenged as well. So if you remember in the late 60s, early 70s, there were all these projects on ape language with signing apes and apes working with computer interfaces. And people were starting to argue that maybe the apes weren't doing quite as much as the people thought they were doing. And then I come up and I'm trying to convince people that a creature with a brain the size of the shelled walnut really is doing what the apes are doing. It was a huge challenge. The particularly American psychology, much more than European ethology, was interested in using what we call operant conditioning, where you starve an animal down to 80% of its normal body weight, you put it in a box, and you give it certain types of fairly simple studies. So you show it a red light goes off, then you give it a red light and a green light, and if the animal hits the red, it gets a reward, so you call that matched a sample, and then you see if they will learn oddity from sample, so see red, hit green, and things like that. And birds weren't doing too well on tasks like that to begin with, and it didn't seem to be that you really needed cognitive processing for this. And finally, other researchers were starting to think about things in terms of Darwinian continuity and that, well, gee, maybe, you know, animal cognition and human cognition, there is a continuity. It's not a sharp break. And so the work that I was doing was constantly challenging the status quo, where people were saying, well, animals are not very bright, and birds are really, if you look at all this research that had been done, the birds are at the bottom of the barrel here. You know, how can you tell me that this bird is smart? And I would say, well, first of all, you're doing it in a sense where you're making it harder for the animal to figure out what the question is. And second, you're using pigeons, which are lovely birds, but they're not the, you know, brightest crayon in the box. If you look at, even then, there was work being done on the area of the bird brain that was the basic complement of the human cortex. So it doesn't look cortical, but it functions cortically, and the human cortex is the seat of intelligence. So if you look at the parrots, the crows, the jays, and the mynahs, that cortical-like area is relatively huge in their brain, the same way it is in our brain compared to other mammals. And you would expect that these parrots and crows would be doing this intelligent type of work to a far greater extent than a bird like the pigeon.
Yeah. And now recently there's been work with crows about they can actually recognize faces, human faces.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. My friends are doing this work, and they're talking about, you know, yeah, we have to use all these masks when we band the baby so we can go back to the nests later and look, and mom and dad won't attack us and things like that.
Hmm. Why has the world of science, or why had the world of science, been slow to recognize animal intelligence, animal personality, and the bond that exists between people and animals?
Oh, there are many, many reasons for that. One, of course, is it's much easier to, you know, to eat animals, to wear their hides, to experiment on them if you don't recognize a continuity between us and them. And I'm not an animal rights activist. I mean, I don't eat a lot of meat, but I do eat some. You know, I live in Boston. I have my sheepskin boots because you can't survive a Boston winter without them. But they're 20 years old, and I don't buy them for vanity's sake. I don't change them each year, you know, for fashion. So the point being that that's one of the things. A lot of people don't want to believe in the continuity. They don't believe in evolution. They don't believe in the continuity between humans and animals in that Darwinian type of sense. So that's also hard for them to accept. And there's the idea in terms of the animal bond. As a scientist, I mean, I talk about this a lot in my book, how I always treated Alex as a colleague. I cared about him, the way I cared about, you know, people, other people with whom I worked. But I drew a line between caring for him in that way and caring for him as you would a child or a spouse, because one had to get a certain objectivity. And a lot of people were afraid that when you start working with these animals so intensely, you can lose your objectivity. So there were all these issues playing out.
And then when Alex died, that dam broke.
Yes, yes. And I realized just what I had been, you know, pushing aside for all those years.
Yeah. Have people, have scientists been interested in companion animals other than birds, cats and dogs, because they have a range of vocalization and they're pretty smart as well? Are we interested in that in the world of science, or is that just too domestic?
Well, no, it's very interesting. In the early 90s, I was in Budapest for a conference, and they were doing a lot of work on dogs. And why were they working on dogs? This was a country that was, you know, very, very poor. Science was not well funded. Something certainly like animal cognition was never going to be funded. dogs were out there. People could bring their dogs into the laboratory. It was easy to work with dogs. So they started this work, and it's caught on. There are now dog labs all over the United States. People are beginning to realize just, you know, the range of intelligence. Some dogs are really smart. Some dogs are less smart. There's a range of intelligence, and these abilities are, you know, across different species. It's not that one species of dog is particularly bright. It's more like the individuals mm-hmm. in that group. There are some dogs that tend to, that have been bred for certain things. So when you look at the dog that, Rico, the border collie, that can take human vocalizations and pick out one of 200 toys that relate to the particular vocalization it's used. You think about it. So border collies were bred to listen to human commands. Very specific commands, because you needed to know, you know, which all these different commands about herding the sheep. So they were actually bred specially for that. So that's a special case. But other types of tests that people are doing, we're learning about dog intelligence.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we were children, we had a Weimaraner, and my mother used the dog to wake us in the morning, and she would say, "Go and get Celeste," and the dog came to me. And she mixed it up. So you didn't know who was going to get the cold nose first. But very interesting. Speaking of children and animals, it was such a wonderful thing to have that dog in my life as a girl. For you, it was a budgie.
Yes, yes. I had a very unusual childhood. Maybe not that unusual, but I grew up above the store. There were no other children around. And my father was going to school. He was teaching full-time. He was going to school part-time, and he was taking care of an elderly mother. So he would kiss me good morning, and I sometimes wouldn't see him till the next morning. My mother had, as a child, basically, she was 16 when her mother died, and she brought up her younger sibs, finished high school and went to work and came home and did all the housework. And so she really was not interested in having a family. She had raised her family already, and then I came along. And she really was not a very interactive person with me. So I was alone, there in this apartment above a store with pretty much nobody to talk to. There was television, which is not interactive. And my father bought me this little budgie. And I kind of joked that this was the only thing that talked to me all day. And, of course, that little budgie didn't talk particularly much. But it was a companion. It was with me all day, doing things with me, eating breakfast with me, and, you know, playing with me and doing all these different things. So.
Yeah, and you could talk.
I could talk to it.
Bird.
Yeah.
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 Again, I mean, at 4 years old, your conversation is not that scintillating either. So
So when was it that you came across Dr. Doolittle?
I'm trying to think. Probably late grade school or somewhere around there when, mm-hmm. you know, the reading skills really picked up. And I was an avid reader, again, as an only child, and in the summers, even when we left this particular place and we moved to a place where there were lots of children around, they all went to camp in the summer, and my parents couldn't afford to send me to camp. So I was home alone with two parents who were not terribly interactive, but then I had books. And so I would spend huge amounts of time reading and, you know, obviously hit the Dr. Doolittle books and always had the budgies.
Yeah.
So I would sit there with the budgie on my shoulder, you know, reading Dr. Doolittle.
There's got to be a great draw children and stories about people who have magical feelings towards animals.
Yeah.
For me, I was always in awe of the story of St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah.
You know, same kind of thing. And it was so magical and wonderful.
Yeah. Well, there's so many stories out there. There was one book I read as a child, Carbonell, King of the Cats, where I think, you know, you drank a potion from the pharmacies. And of course, this was written in Britain, so it was the chemists. And there was it used to be when we were growing up that the pharmacies and chemists had big red bottles and big green bottles in the front of the
mm-hmm.
thing. What they meant, who knows? But if you drank one of them, you could talk to the animals. And if you drank the other, you lost that ability. And that was one of the, you know, fascinating mm-hmm. books that I read. And there were so many of them as a childhood that you would do something and all of a sudden. And then as an adult getting into the field, one of the first books I read was King Solomon's Ring by Conrad Lorenz, who was a German ethologist. And he basically you know, titled the book based on the magical ring that King Solomon was supposed to have that allowed him to talk to the animals. But Lorenz was saying, no, you can learn how to talk to them by observing them and watching them and interacting with them. And you get to learn all about their behaviors and you can interact that way.
Yeah. And some adults are still enjoying the magic. People who write books like that, people who draw comic strips like Mutz or Red and Rover. So,
yeah.
Well, how did you know that science would be the field you would pursue?
My father was a frustrated biochemist. He was always very, you know, eager for me to follow in his idea. He actually was a teacher, grade school teacher, but he's always wanted me to be the scientist he wasn't. And I was very good at it. When I was in high school, I turned out to be very, very good in chemistry, which surprised me because I had been so frightened of it. But I turned out to be very good. And it fascinated me in the regularity of it and how you could maybe predict, you know, chemical reactions. I mean, everybody else used to memorize them, but I used to sit there and figure out, well, there was a pattern to this and you could predict how it would work. And that fascinated me. And then reading about Marie Curie and people like that, there were women doing this work, which again, in you know, my generation, that was a big issue.
Yeah. I remember from the book Alex and Me that it came as a surprise to you that you could go to MIT.
Yes. I didn't think girls went to MIT, but yes, they did. And of course, I was the first quote unquote large class. We were all of 50 women out of 1,200 students. So it wasn't that common an occurrence. But yeah, again, growing up in the 50s as a child, there were no, because there were people like Marie Curie. But in general, there were no real women role models.
Yeah. There weren't many, if very, very few, women in broadcasting.
Yeah.
So same kind of thing. Yeah. I can do that. I'd like to do that.
Yes. Yeah.
So also, seeing as that we're here in a national public radio station, Illinois Public Media, and downstairs we have a television station that's affiliated with PBS, I think we should put in a plug for Nova.
Oh, yes, because that's what really triggered this. So here I am now in graduate school at Harvard. Not a very happy chemist. I'm doing some theoretical work, which, again, you got to think about computers were the size of a room at this stage. And I'm thinking it's taking me 7 years to do this. And, down the road, it's going to take some computer. I was thinking 7 minutes, probably now it's 7 nanoseconds to do the calculations. But was not really happy in it. Again, as a woman, the women who were graduating just before me were having terrible times getting positions. And I just was no longer as interested in the field. And I was watching Nova programs. This was the first year of Nova. And again, I have to back up a little bit and say, well, as an undergraduate at MIT, biology was slice and dice. There was no such thing as an animal behavior course or anything like that. Animal behavior, even on television, you'd watch. Occasionally, there might be a documentary about this woman from Africa doing, Jane Goodall doing some work, but that was, really rare. Most of the time, it was Marlon Perkins and Jim, wrestling some,
right.
Wrestling some animal to the ground.
Mutual of Omaha.
Yeah, measuring it and letting it go. That was, animal behavior. So I'm watching these NOVA programs on the signing chimps, and this is done by researchers at universities, respected researchers, teaching an ape sign language. And the really critical one for me was Why Do Birds Sing?, where they're talking about how birds learn their song. This is very complicated. It might have meaning. And it just, everything came together, and I'm going, but parakeets, I had parrots. They talked. I bet you could teach them meaningful speech. I mean, my birds did things that were relevant. It was, you come home and they'd say, hello, and things like that. It wasn't real communication, but I'm thinking, I bet if you use the proper techniques, you could teach a parrot. So that really triggered this idea of switching fields. And being at Harvard, I went over to the Museum of Comparative Zoology saying, I want to switch fields. And they looked at me and they said, you're ABD. You're just, all you have to do is finish writing that thesis. Finish the thesis in chemistry, but sit in on whatever courses you want to take here. It's okay, that's fine. So I promptly started spending 40 hours a week finishing the doctorate and 40 hours a week sitting in on courses, doing reading, going to seminars all over the Boston area, because this was a hot new topic, animal communication and animal cognition. These were new in the 70s. So, yeah, that's where it started.
You're really tenacious, aren't you?
Yeah. Some people call it stubborn, but...
Well, that reminds me of Alex, because he was certainly stubborn or tenacious,
yes,
however you want to put it, and he kept you going through some pretty tough times.
Yeah. We were definitely partners through a lot. I mean, we would, you know, there would be periods where the grant money would dry up, and I'd sit there looking at him and going, you know, okay, kiddo, you got to come up with something new and fascinating, because we won't be here tomorrow if you don't. And things like that, yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Irene Pepperberg. She's an associate research professor of psychology at Brandeis University. She teaches animal cognition at Harvard University. She's the author of Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. The book was published in hardcover in 2008. It was released last year in a paperback edition. Professor Pepperberg, is also the author of The Alex Studies, Cognitive and Communicative Abilities of Gray Parrots, and her work has been featured in news media around the world. She's in Champaign-Urbana for a public lecture this evening at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. It's free and open to the public. It's set for 7 o'clock this evening. The lecture, Contemplating Creatures, Irene Pepperberg and the Hidden World of Animal Intelligence. Again, free and open to the public. It will be held at the College of Veterinary Medicine in Urbana, which is on Lincoln Avenue. And I am told that free parking is available in lot F27. So, good deal. All right. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We've got about 5 minutes left. No, maybe a little bit more than that. Maybe closer to 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455, if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area. We also can be reached by email. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. How did you begin to build your bond with Alex? Because when you first got him from a pet store in Chicago and you were living in West Lafayette, Indiana, he was a scared bird.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he had been with eight other birds in a pet store, and all of a sudden some big net comes, scoops him up, gets flipped on his back, beak, wings, toes, clip, shoved in a box, and driven across and wherever. And my then husband got him out of the box by using big gloves because, you know, didn't want to get bitten. So his original, you know, idea was that we were not good. But just by sitting there for hours and talking to him and, you know, just letting him sit there and listen to me talk to him, giving him treats, you know, he had all his regular food, but if he wanted a really special treat, he'd have to, you know, stick his head a little bit closer to that hand of mine and get it. And eventually he started realizing she's okay. You know, she's not gonna be a bad person. And he climbed out of the cage pretty quickly, so that was good. And then we could start training. We'd show him that, you know, if I show you this thing and I label it and you label it for me back and you get it, and he started realizing that, oh, these sounds are meaningful and can get me nice toys to play with and things like that. So it was a slow process. Very slow process.
Let's take a call from a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I feel very lucky that I turned on the radio and there you were. I have 4 cats and a black lab, and I'm almost daily being surprised by one of them doing things that I thought nobody could do, let alone a cat or a dog. And the spinoff of that is that it would be nice to have a manual or a small handbook or a pamphlet that says, measure your dog or cat's or whatever's intelligence if it can do the following things in a certain period of time or can learn certain things. You have a normal one or an intelligent one or one that's dumb. And I wondered if there's anything online like that that would pick and choose sort of from the kind of experiments that are being done in research, whether that sort of thing is available for the general public to look at. And secondly, I know this is not politically correct, but from my experience, women are much better working with animals than men. it could be simply the macho thing, but a lot of the phrases you said during the program I've heard from my mother, my grandmother, and other women when I was growing up, and now the lady I'm with now talks about those kinds of things. And I started getting, well, get with it, and all of a sudden the dog's following me and doing things that it never did before because I've changed my language and the phraseology a lot and doing it the way the girlfriend's doing it. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I'll answer the second one first because we actually did a senior thesis on this. One of my students was noticing that the Alex responded better to the women in the lab rather than the men. And he actually liked men better because if a strange man came into the lab, he would jump up on the guy's shoulders and start courtship feeding and all this. So he kind of liked men better, but he worked better with women. So she basically videotaped interactions of women who had children, women who didn't have children, men who had children, men who didn't have children, people who thought that this was a male bird, Alex, and then we had people who didn't know about the study, and we said that this is Alice, and had them come in and work. And it turned out there was not one single thing that men versus women did, but in general, you got it right. The men were in some ways trying to dominate him, and the women were trying to work with him. So men would hold a toy a little bit over his head, where women would hold the toy kind of more like under his head, is a less threatening type of way, and wouldn't kind of stand over him as much, but would kind of try to look him in the eye more and things like that. So it was a constellation of things that guys were doing differently from what women were doing. So there is a point to that. The first question, would be a great thing for somebody to put together. I think the issue is that what we find with animals just like humans is that there are many different types of intelligence. If you read stuff by Howard Gardner and Richard Steinberg, Robert Steinberg right now, you find that it's a big thing in human psychology about different type people being good at certain things and not being good at other things. And we find this with animals. So, you know, Alex, he was very good at talking, but we gave him a physical problem to solve and he looked at us and, you know, basically said, you pick up nut. I'm not going to do the stupid string pulling task. You know, I talk and you do the physical work. Whereas, you know, it would make him look kind of stupid in some ways. And the birds who didn't have language yet immediately started pulling up the string and getting their nuts. So it's a matter of different personalities and different ideas. And so it's very hard to draw that kind of a manual. We're learning that with humans. You know, you give a standard intelligence test and you miss so many different types of intelligence. But, you know, there's probably somebody out there who, hearing this program, will take you up on it and have a new bestseller, you know, in a couple of months.
That would be great. I'd read it.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
We've gotten a question from someone listening, and it came in through email. How do you facilitate avian enrichment in a captive environment? What are you doing from a researcher's standpoint? We are using foraging toys, but I'm wondering what's out there on the horizon.
Yeah. This is again, wonderful question. Foraging toys are a great breakthrough. Unfortunately, parrots are really smart, and lots of times they figure these foraging toys out in about, you know, the first couple of times it takes them an hour or two, then it's, you know, and then you put it in 30 seconds, it's done. And this was the kind of work that we were doing at the Media Lab. This, again, this idea of an interped explorer where the bird could, you know, pull up movies it might want to or music it might want to, or maybe even somehow connect to other birds through this. Those things, you know, the work at the Media Lab fell apart for various reasons. I'm guessing that somebody's going to pick that up again at some point. But the birds really need social interaction. I mean, foraging toys are great because they do spend a lot of time foraging in the wild, but they often spend it foraging with other individuals. And this is not a plug to go out and buy a second bird for your bird, because it would be like, you know, online dating. You don't necessarily, you know, like the matches that are chosen for you. So it's not necessarily that having more is better. You know, that's something else to think about. The two birds dislike one another. I mean, Alex and Griffin got along, but Alex and Griffin, neither of them liked Arthur, and Arthur doesn't like Griffin, and there's a lot of tension between them in the laboratory. So, you know, it's a really big, important issue, and I encourage people out there who have abilities to start thinking about these things and start trying to come up with more more exotic ways of keeping these birds enriched because they desperately need it.
Yeah. What is a foraging toy? What does that
mean? Oh, it's so for example, it will be a like a little circle inside a circle, and you have to line up the two circles so that the nut will drop through the hole.
Gotcha.
And, you know, birds, the first time they see it, oh, it takes them forever to figure this out. And then each time it's like, oops, and then, you know, they get it mm-hmm. right away. Or pulling out different types of pegs to release the top. And, you know, again, the first time, oh, they can't do it. And then, you know, they start getting it very quickly. So, again, it's better than nothing.
Yeah. Well, our cat enjoyed for about an hour or two a video of birds in the wild.
Right.
You know, a DVD is slided right in there. And then after a while, he goes, this is
It's the same movie. Now, if you had a video camera on a feeder outside, yeah, that might be different because it's going to change.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Irene Pepperberg, and we're going to have to wrap up here. Just a word or two about current research and what you and your students are currently working on.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned briefly, we're trying to figure out how the birds literally see the world. And to do this, we're looking at optical illusions. Now, the first one that Alex did do, it's called the Mueller-Lyer illusion, and everybody's going to go, ugh. But you've all seen it. It's two lines, and one line has arrows pointing inward, and one line has arrows pointing outward. And the one with the outward arrows always looks longer than mm-hmm. the one with the inward arrows. And, you know, think about that. We have binocular vision. Birds have their eyes on opposite sides of their head. They don't have the same connections within the brain for the visual system as we do. And yet Alex saw this exactly the way we do. And if you make those arrows, you know, if you spread the arrows out so that they're almost perpendicular, he started to lose the illusion the way we do. If you angle them in tighter so the illusion is stronger, he saw it more strongly. You make that inner line really thick so when you see it, you focus on that inner line and not on the arrows. Mm-hmm. You lose the illusion, he lost the illusion. So it was fascinating that this very different visual system saw things, and that tells us something about it being a very elementary bit of the visual system that's picking that up. We started a second illusion, and we didn't finish it before he passed. So now we're trying to do those things with Griffin.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Really been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Again, thank you.
Irene Pepperberg, she is an associate research professor of psychology at Brandeis and teaches animal cognition at Harvard University. She's the author of Alex and Me, which is now available in paperback. She's in Champaign-Urbana for a free public lecture this evening at 7 o'clock at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine.